Hello, and welcome to JAMA Evidence, our monthly podcast focused on core issues in evidence-based medicine. I'm David Simel, the editor of the Rational Clinical Examination series and professor of medicine at the Durham Veterans Affairs Medical Center and Duke University. Today, we're discussing intubation. Joining me to talk about this topic is Dr. Michael Detsky, who is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Toronto and the Mount Sinai Health System. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
Great. To start, can you tell us how you define difficult intubation and what is the overall incidence of that?
Sure. So, I mean, to me, I think having a universal definition can be quite challenging. I personally think of it as being unable to pass the endotracheal tube on a first attempt. But for the purposes of our rational clinical exam paper, that tended not to be the definition that was used in most papers. The majority used a scoring system called the Cormac-Lehane, which is a visual scoring system of the vocal cords and epiglottis at the time of laryngoscopy. And so most of the papers used a score of 3 to 4, which was generally considered difficult. And a score of 3 means you can only see the epiglottis but cannot see the vocal cords at all. And a score of 4 indicates you can't even see the epiglottis at all. So that was the definition used in most of the papers in our study. And then the next most common would be the intubation difficulty scale, which was a score made up of a composite of a number of operators, number of attempts, number of alternative techniques used, as well as some other features, including lifting force and whether laryngeal pressure was used and how well the vocal cords were moving. In the overall incidence of our papers, we found that these papers tended to define difficult intubation at about 10%, meaning 1 out of 10 patients met the criteria for having a difficult intubation.
Okay, so for someone like me who doesn't do airway management, every intubation would be difficult, but right. That's not true for you. So if you anticipate a difficult intubation, what steps can you do to increase the likelihood of success on your first attempt?
That's a great and controversial question. I think a lot of different clinicians who practice advanced airway techniques will have a slightly different approach. Me, as a critical care clinician, my approach is to try and get the best view of the vocal cords without putting the patient at risk to experiencing worsening hypoxemia or cardiovascular complications because of the drugs that we use to facilitate the intubation. So I am on one end of the spectrum where I try to use as little drugs as possible to try and make sure the patient stays alive. So for me, that includes using topical xylocaine, which is not systemically absorbed, and using as little amount of sedation or analgesia possible during the time of intubation. And I would also have the patient sitting upright so that they have optimized their respiratory mechanics to try and prevent them from running into trouble when they stop breathing. Now, other people at the other end of the spectrum might say, well, I just want to get the best view possible so I can get the endotracheal tube in as quickly as possible. And they might have a slightly different approach where they use drugs in a way that they use them quickly, they monitor the hemodynamics, and then they try and get the breathing tube in as quickly as possible. So those are the sort of two ends of the spectrum, and I'm more of the end of trying to keep the patient breathing spontaneously with using as little drugs as possible. Now, these drugs can suppress a patient's adrenergic drive, leading to cardiovascular collapse. And to me, even a brief moment of apnea might cause serious complications from an oxygenation or acid-base status. So that's the reason I take that approach. But I recognize that by doing that, it means getting the view of the vocal cords will become a little bit more difficult because the patient might be moving a little bit or breathing on their own. So again, it's hard to answer that question in a way that I think everyone would agree is the best approach to go forward with someone that you anticipate being a difficult intubation. Also, if I anticipate because of the clinical features that I think we're going to get into later in the interview that someone's going to be a difficult intubation, you try and have as many expertise around that can help out someone managing the drugs and the hemodynamics. You know, I might tend to use as a first pass using video laryngoscopy as opposed to direct laryngoscopy. I think that's especially true in the COVID era where we're trying to minimize the clinician's exposure to the patient's mouth. So try and keep some distance there, and also consider adjuncts, including fiber optic bronchoscopy or having a bougie available as well.
Well, there are two types of situations. There's an emergency situation where you've got to get airway management quickly, and then there are situations that are a little bit more elective. But let's talk about the emergency situation first. I didn't anticipate that my patient was going to acutely deteriorate. I hit the code button and you and your colleagues come running in, and you just don't have time to thoroughly examine a patient's neck and sort of oropharynx. So on hitting the room, when you look at the patient, what strikes you right away as, uh-oh, this is going to be tough?
That's a good question also. I think, so the situation you just described where the patient's sort of arrested and there's really not much time and someone's maybe started doing CPR and then you get to the head of the bed to try and examine whether you can intubate them. Usually in those circumstances, I think the exam will be very limited. It's sort of observing what the patient's face looks like, what their neck looks like. You'll have a sense of maybe how mobile the cervical spine is because you're going to manipulate it in an attempt to optimize your laryngoscopy. And so I think in those circumstances, there's really not a lot you can do to try and evaluate whether it's going to be difficult. I can also say that having intubated patients during sort of a code blue scenario, that you're also trying to limit pauses in the CPR that the patient is receiving. So I'll tend to just make an attempt to do laryngoscopy and intubation while CPR is ongoing. And obviously that's going to be a little bit more difficult than if no one's pushing on the patient's chest. However, in the ICU, I would say a lot of the times there's patients who, you know, you can anticipate they're going to get intubated, but it's not going to happen in seconds. You're more looking at kind of minutes to half an hour to an hour. And I think in those circumstances, you do have an opportunity to do some minimal cursory physical exam. I think based on our data from the rational clinical exam paper, the one exam that would be most helpful is the upper lip bite test, which is having the patient try to bite their upper lip with their lower teeth. And I can tell you personally, I've done this in patients who are sort of on the road to needing intubation, but aren't quite there yet. And they might not be completely mentating normally, but they're still able to follow that relatively simple command. There are other things you can do. You can look at the jaw to see if the jaw is receding. You can use your fingers to estimate the hyomental distance, which is the distance between the hyoid bone and the end of the chin. You can assess neck flexion and extension, either have the patient do it actively, or if they're not awake enough, you can gently, passively do that to get a sense of how well their neck is moving. You know, the most widely tested examination, the Mallampati, still reported by clinicians to clinicians as an estimate of whether you think the patient's going to be difficult or not, but doesn't have the same predictive accuracy of a difficult intubation as some of the aforementioned tests.
Yeah, I've noticed when I send people for a colonoscopy that the gastroenterologist always records a Mallampati score. Could you say a little bit more about what that score is?
Sure. So it's certainly the most widely cited exam for difficult intubation. And it's basically a scoring system that evaluates the ability to look at the different structures within the oral cavity. And it ranges from 1 to 4, with 1 being the patient opens their mouth and you can see everything, including the full view of the uvula, the anterior and posterior pillars. And the score gets from 1 down to 4. Grades 3 and 4 are sort of considered that they're going to be a difficult intubation. And that tends to be that you can't see really the uvula in grade 3, or you can't really see any of the structures in the mouth in grade 4.
So, Mike, I need to tell you a funny story about the upper lip bite test. The week of your publication, I was in the hospital and got on the elevator, and I don't know what you call a group of anesthesiologists, but a group of anesthesiologists and anesthesia trainees came in, and they all were making grimaces at each other and laughing about the upper lip bite score. So it gave me a lot of instant gratification. But can you say a little bit more about that? Describe it, and how useful is it?
Sure. So, you know, it's funny because locally we had the same experience too. The upper lip bite test, so it's really an estimate of how well the patient can bite their upper lip with their lower teeth. And to me, I think it's a combination of jaw mobility and mouth opening. So the way the scoring system works is a grade three would be that the patient can't bite their upper lip at all with their lower teeth. A grade two means they can bite the upper lip but can't get above the upper border of the upper lip, also known as the vermilion. And a class one is, I should have said class, not grade. A class one means they can bite above the vermilion border. Now, before doing this study, this was something I hadn't really known that much about. It wasn't something I had read that much about, but it actually performs quite well, especially if people are unable to bite their upper lip at all, giving you a positive likelihood ratio of 14. Whereas in the study that looked at being unable to bite above the upper border gave you a likelihood ratio positive of 12. So, I mean, that's a pretty strong positive likelihood ratio in terms of predicting whether someone's going to be a difficult intubation or not. And to me, it's a relatively simple test to do. It doesn't require any additional materials, including measurement tools or flashlights. So to me, I think it's a very, and you can do it relatively quickly. So to me, it's, if you're only going to do one test, I think that's the test to do.
Yeah, I just took a selfie of myself and I'm in good shape. I'm glad to hear this.
Okay. Now, it's important to recognize that doesn't rule out a difficult intubation. It just potentially rules in a difficult intubation.
Yeah, you mentioned a little early on about COVID-19. And, you know, tell us a little bit about how the possibility of difficult intubation has affected clinical care.
Sure. So, I mean, obviously, this has been a really challenging era in modern medicine with so many patients requiring intubation. Locally here in Toronto, at my particular hospital, we haven't fortunately had that many patients who've been intubated on the ward. We've had some, but most of ours have actually been transferred from other hospitals. So initially, before the pandemic started, when, you know, in the early stages, a group had come together to come up with a plan on how to communicate whether a patient might be a difficult intubation or not. And they came up with a tool, more or less using these amazing figures from the rational clinical exam paper that we had, that the JAMA group put together, to basically put on the patient's chart so that a clinician could come and do these assessments and then score how they did to give the potential intubator a sense of whether the patient is anticipated to be difficult or not. And I haven't really seen it been used that much just because of what I said earlier, that we haven't had that many people get intubated on the ward. So I can't really comment on whether this was helpful or not. But to me, I think it makes sense. And I think anyone coming in who's COVID-19 positive, who's requiring supplemental oxygen, I think it's, you know, you could do a pretty helpful physical exam within 5 minutes using some of the tests that we have here. And that can maybe communicate that whether you anticipate, you know what, this patient, if they end up needing to be intubated, could be quite difficult. That being said, I think more of the issues around difficulty in intubating these patients is the concern about how hypoxemic they might become. And how I described my approach to intubation earlier, I've taken a slightly different approach with the COVID-19 patients, because these patients were trying to mitigate the risk of exposure to the clinician who are getting intubated. So we're actually doing more of the giving medications and paralyzing the patient and then doing the intubation so that we're not generating droplets throughout the room to expose all the clinicians in the room who are part of the intubation process.
Well, thanks, Mike. Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners about the clinical examination to predict a difficult intubation?
You know, I think it's important to recognize that there's limitations to the exam, that no one finding really helps rule out a difficult intubation. In fact, of the summary statistics, the lowest negative likelihood ratio, which was negative 0.28, was for the palm print, which is a requiring ink and a piece of white paper and having the patient create an impression of their palm using ink and paper, which is meant to represent limitations in the mobility of the small joints of the hands, which is used as a potential surrogate for limitations in the mobility of the cervical spine and jaw. I've never seen this used in clinical practice. You can imagine it's quite cumbersome to do. So it's important to recognize that some of these things might help you rule in a difficult intubation, but in general, there's not something that really helps you rule out a difficult intubation. So I think anytime someone's critically ill, you should anticipate that this could be a difficult intubation. I also want to comment that all of the studies that we have in our paper, which are the level 1 to 3 papers that required an independent assessor of intubation, they all generally happen in an operating room. So this may not translate completely to the emergent situation that we've been describing in this conversation.
Well, thanks for the discussion today, Mike. Information about this topic is available in the Rational Clinical Examination series published in JAMA. For more of our podcast, visit us at jamanetworkaudio.com. You can listen as a subscriber wherever you get your podcasts.